Hello and welcome to the Australian Baby Boomer podcast and Happy New Year for 2022. I'm looking forward to interviewing many more interesting people in this space this year. Initially, the idea of the podcast was to provide a forum for Australians over, say, the age of 50 to be interviewed on a topic of their choice. Often this involved interviewees reflecting on their work life, an interest or passion that they have, such as a creative endeavour or volunteer work, or early memories of life and childhood, and we've had some creative writing sprinkled throughout. Another emerging theme has been a reflection on life, meaning, and death. This is understood by those with the advantage of having the long view by virtue of maturity, so many having lived through periods of difficulty and ultimately having made it through into calmer waters. Or that is the hope, at any rate. Life, meaning, death. These are the themes explored in today's discussion. Today's guest is poet and novelist PJ Johnson. I've interviewed Pat previously, and at that time we agreed she would come back to talk about her new novel once it was published. So PJ has recently published a novel called Isla Rising through Ferguson Books. It is a beautifully realised work of fiction, which explores some of the themes mentioned above, namely life and death, but particularly the transitional space between the two. I'll read a little bit from the blurb on the back to give a flavour of what the story is about, and hopefully this will contextualise the discussion that follows. It is 1833. And fiery Edinburgh widow Isla is dying. Ready to meet her maker and eager to reunite with the love of her life, she is not afraid of passing. But Isla's death is only the beginning of a series of otherworldly adventures that she must undertake on her quest to find her husband. I met with PJ at the Fremantle Arts Centre Cafe. So you will notice that this recording has the somewhat nostalgic sound in the background of people enjoying themselves. In Western Australia, we're relatively unrestricted at the moment. Anyway, I began by asking about the setting of the novel in Edinburgh, 1833.
Well, I went to Edinburgh and found that it was a very atmospheric place. I went for the Edinburgh Festival and the sun was shining and it was all a really positive experience, but it was easy to imagine it being cold and drizzly and a little bit more somber. And it was built with a lot of grey stone, and it was very solid, very steep, and a very interesting place. A lot of medical advances and scientific discoveries and literature have come out of Scotland, and it just appealed to me on that basis. But also I was interested in the phenomenon of grave robbing, which was happening during that time in history, like the first half of the 19th century. It was a big thing for doctors to buy cadavers in order to dissect them and find out how the human body worked. I know it's extremely grisly to think of, but I think that the intersection of the physical with the possible spiritual implications of that was really a hook for me to look at what was what. At that time.
Yeah.
I was also interested in how poor people survived at that time, that they were driven to such acts as grave robbing because their circumstances were so bad. In the winter they were cold and hungry, and it's exactly the sort of thing that would be available to someone who was desperate. So all those things, I thought, would make a good story.
Yeah, and they did too. I read the story and I absolutely loved it. I think, you know, that time and place, the intersection between the physical and the spiritual too, would have been so much more in the minds of the people of that time, because it was a time when people were more religious, I guess, and more aware of the spiritual side of things. So that ups the ante a little bit too, doesn't it?
It does.
And you've talked about, I guess, is it a festival of Samhain, which is to do with that time between, I guess it's a time between seasons, but also a time between life and death, and where the living and the dead commune. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where you found out about that.
Well, in the US where I come from, Halloween was always a big, big holiday, but it had no serious significance. It was fun. But other cultures of the world consider it quite a serious thing, like Mexico.
The Day of the Dead.
Yeah, South America and places like that. And ancient cultures always had big festivals at the dying of one year and the resurrection of the next in the spring. So the holiday of Samhain does signify that passing away. And they do have the spring festival, which is called Beltane, which happens on May Day, first of May. So it's the same storyline, basically. So I found the Festival of Samhain full of arcane and otherworldly significance. There was, you know, people would dress up in disguise. They would celebrate extravagantly. The bonfires were lit all over the place, and there was a lot of dancing and sort of capering and gymnastics and fire throwing and all sorts of things. But it also had this spooky, scary aspect to it, because at the time that I wrote about, you had a number of Scottish churches like the Calvinist, Presbyterian, Methodist, I think, and they're all rather strict. They're all rather serious about religion. So the idea of someone interfering with the dead and their journey to their afterlife would be taken extremely seriously by most people. And unlike today, people were religious. It was a fairly universal belief system that kept their society cohesive, and it wasn't, even the grave robbers, the criminals, you know, everyone still had a kind of a basic belief in God. So that also made it a pretty interesting time.
Yeah. And when you go to Edinburgh, and there were so much, there's the old town and the new town and that sort of thing, and I think there were a lot of quite harsh punishments for people who did actually fairly minor things. And
very harsh.
Yes.
And also, I found illogical, because when I started researching, I found out that for grave robbing, the penalty was possibly being transported or maybe going to jail. But if you robbed a grave, it was death. And this seemed to me not sensible. I would have thought grave robbing would have been much the worst crime. And I can see where Marx got the idea that property is theft, if that's the kind of thing that was going on at the time. So once I found that out, I had more desire to explore that part of it, part of the moral fabric of the time.
So a lot of these story takes place where, you know, that other world or the threshold world, really. It's not actually left this world, but it's almost like this ghostly figure of Isla making her way around and trying to influence, I guess, the living world in some ways, where she's got concerns about her granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how you imagined that world and went into that? Did you research anything like near-death experiences or anything like that?
Well, of course, I heard a lot about near-death experiences and after-death experiences from people who thought they'd been visited by a family member or something, but I didn't actually research it for the book, because I had a pretty definite idea of what I wanted, how I wanted to portray that, and I would be in danger of messing it up if I got, you know, if I researched too much. So I followed my instinct on that journey. But I did try to keep people in their characters that they were in when they were alive. They didn't change once they died. And with Isla, she's quite frustrated because she's not able to have much influence on the actions of people who are still alive. She's observing them and trying to send them her thoughts, but she can't interfere in any way, and her only the only one she can have any sort of communication with is her cat, who is still alive and who is very receptive to Isla, and very unusual cat. So, and it, you know, at that time of the year, Samhain, and also in certain places in Scotland, they speak of the place being thin. In other words, there's only a thin layer between this world and the other world
at that particular time.
Yes, and in particular places, like particular islands.
Mm.
And so that was a belief already established. And underneath the main, the dead could be seen by the living. That was the belief. So a lot of people were very keen to see, you know, their relatives or friends or whatever, if they could. So, and of course, you know, there was no guarantee you were going to see anything, but there was that possibility that was believed in. So that was I thought that would be fascinating.
Yeah. Do you know if they still celebrate Samhain in Ireland?
Yeah, they do. Apparently this year there's going to be a huge, they're calling it a fire festival, on the 31st of October. And that's kind of what it always was. It was always a lot of bonfires and being in the cold, dark, with the fires blazing. And so there's going to be a huge parade type thing. Yeah, and in different cities in Scotland. So
does the fire have a particular significance?
Sure. Actually, I don't know. I didn't research that. I didn't find anything about it.
I think if it's cold and dark and everything, it's probably quite pleasant having a fire.
Yeah.
I liked the way you handled the cat as a co-narrator as well, or as the point of view. I thought it was very sensitively done, and whereas I think that could have gone horribly wrong. Was that a difficult process, using the cat?
Well, it was an interesting exploration of a living creature. creature without emotion so much, more someone who's a little bit cynical and a step back from her humans and can see where they make all these mistakes because, you know, they've got this human frailty, whereas she's just very practical.
Mm. Yeah, so you couldn't have used a dog in that case, could you? Because I can see with that makes me think when you mentioned that's why a cat works, and what you've done with that is to keep the cat objective and distance.
The cats always are fairly disdainful of their owners, you know.
And symbolic too, I guess, there's all those connotations of witches and other magical things to do with cats. And, you know, Alice in Wonderland, the Cheshire cat that comes and goes, you know, that sort of thing. There's so many.
And witches at the time were believed to have the cat as their familiar. There was lots of good things about using a cat. Whereas a dog would have been hopeless. Dogs are just trying to please you all the time, so they're not objective.
No, it would be a different story, wouldn't it? We talked in the last podcast that you were interviewed, and you mentioned your home or your place of birth and where you grew to adulthood as being a very cold, distinctively cold place, and I wondered about the seasons and that, you know, whether you drew on some of that feeling when you were writing, how helpful that was.
I find it easy to write about being cold and the snow and, you know, the chill, the clamminess and all that sort of thing, and what it was like to move from indoors to outdoors, and how people have their heavy outdoor clothing, and, you know, the difference it makes. It was a very cold place, and there was a lot of snow. It could snow up to a metre deep, and in which case our whole city just shut down. Nobody could get to work until the ploughs had been through, which would take all day to get everywhere. Kids couldn't get to school. You know, I remember lying in bed early in the morning listening to the radio to find out if school was closed that day because we were snowed in, and then feeling very, very happy about being able to stay home and have a game of Monopoly or something, something like that. It was a nice feeling, but at the same time, there was no way to avoid the cold in the big picture. Yeah.
So, particularly at the moment where we are, which is the extreme heat.
We are, aren't we?
And you're quite a good book to read, I guess, in that respect as well.
Yeah, it might cool you off.
Yeah. Whereabouts can people get the book if they would like to purchase it?
It's at Planet Books in Mount Lawley.
Yeah.
It's also on all the online suppliers like Booktopia and Amazon and Fishpond and different ones. But I suggest going to Planet Books because I've found out since the book was published that those online places can charge whatever price they like, and they are. So,
yes. And it's good to support, if you're living in Western Australia, to support your local bookseller so they don't disappear as well.
Oh, you can also get it from the Isle of Rising website, so it's $18.95.
Right, and I'll leave a link to that on the summary that accompanies this.
I've also found out that some people in Italy have bought it.
Oh, really?
I think that's really interesting. So,
yes.
I have to have a look at their belief in the afterlife.
I think it's such a universal thing in a way. I think just about every culture has got that.
Absolutely.
And it's really just the recent couple of decades where the cynicism has become so much about that type of thing. I think there's something in human beings that's curious about that type of thing, and it is an interesting area to think about.
Mm.
But this has been in the Fremantle Arts Centre Cafe, which is why there's been ambient background noise, including birds and kids what have you. So as far as I can, I'll try and clean this up, but that'll be there.
Okay.
Thanks, Pat, for agreeing to talk about this. I think it will be of interest to a lot of people. And it's only a small book, but I think it's one of those cases where there's a lot packed into a small space, whereas sometimes you can get something that's, you know, twice as long, but not as rich in that sense. So I think it's actually a perfect length. It's, who was it said something about, you know, I didn't have time to write something short, so I've got something long. So, I think that's probably it. Okay, thanks.
Thanks to PJ Johnson for agreeing to talk about the themes explored in her novel, Isla Rising. As she mentioned in the interview, the point of view mainly swings between that of Isla and that of the cat, who steps back to present a cooler, more objective perspective. Although from the following excerpt read by the author, I think you may find, as I did, that it is a perspective that is not without a degree of tolerance and compassion. Thank you again for listening, and please enjoy this reading from the novel itself.
I know what will happen now. Things will become more and more tiresome. So I leap up onto the window ledge and fuss and fidget until they let me out. I wander around for a wee while, and after a time I meet a couple of mates, and we sit together in the sun, gossiping and drowsing, and sometimes having a wee play fight. After the sun sets, they head off, and I go right home for my dinner, and maybe a saucer of cream if I am lucky. And who's to say what will fall to the floor? Hannah is right canny, but she knows what a good mouser I am. And so I am. Not a mouse to be found in my house. No, nor the shop either. After eating, I fall to being bored again, so off I go to see what I can see. For night time is the right time for cats. I trek along until I come to Kelton Burial Ground. I like it here. It's usually peaceful. And sometimes I sit on a headstone and watch the comings and goings of the old spirits who hang about, unable to move on. But tonight there is a light and a sound of clanging like Highland claymores taking part in a sword fight. Not a great din, but a distinct one, and I hurry to spy on what is going on. And here are a couple of lads I know. Grave robbers they are. One, in torn and ragged clothes, digs, while the other, Crow, who is a deal taller, keeps a lookout. Hurry, Tom, urges Crow, holding a lantern above the grave. Tom hurries. Crow is dark, with dark eyes and black hair, and as menacing as the crow he is named for. If he was a crow, I could catch and eat him. He looks warily around, but keeps an eye on his partner, who is not to be trusted. Not ever. Tom's ears stand out like jug handles, and his poor dim eyes reflect the light from the lantern. The burial ground is a lonely place for them. Lonely and frightening, even for Crow, however hard he pretends to be a brave one. And the night is black as pitch. I wonder if they picked it for its very blackness. Because without moonlight, the watcher in the tower will not see them, unless they are very unlucky. Tom grunts and digs until he hears a thud, whereat he giggles like a child. Shh. In the dark, Crow scowls. He jumps down and begins to scrape away the dirt with his hands. They do not lift out the coffin, but wrestle off the heavy lid. Inside, it is painted with gold and silver stars. They do not notice me there, watching. No, they are too much of a rush. Now comes the nasty part. They lift up the body, not yet light but stiff as a plank, and place it in the barrow they have brought. Some of the spirits have gathered round now. They do not like grave robbers, and watch with expressions of great Gaelic disapproval. At Tom's feet, a creature slithers past. The air around us vibrates as a tawny owl swoops down. Too-woo, too-woo, it calls. Tom lets out a cry. He does not like the burial ground with its dark plots and atmosphere of dread. He goes there only to please Crow, who looks after him and whom he idolizes. Crow is his father and his mother, and Tom will do as he wishes, whether he hates it or not. He digs for Crow, and as he digs, he closes his mind to everything else. I do not dislike Tom, but Crow, ugh, how he does pull the wee manny's strings. I cannot say he does not look after Tom, because he does, but he does not always treat him well. To be sure, they have no home, no work, no money, and they only do this to eat. It makes it hard for me, scavenger as I am, to feel too harsh about them. The spirits have no such reservations and begin to move about, letting off that feeling of menace that they are so good at. The two men shove the coffin lid back on, fill in the grave, and get away as quick as ever they can. They meet no one, only a thin and dirty grey cat that stares at them in silence before bolting with a yowl over the low stone wall. It is only Mooney, who is, I know, as harmless as a butterfly on the breeze. I consider and decide to follow them, for I ken where they are going, and I like to keep an eye on such enterprises as theirs. To the east, a cold wind springs up and rain mists down. It will soak them through before they get far. It is a bit of distance to Little France Crescent, where the Royal Infirmary and Dr. Walters lives. So I run up past them and jump up onto the barrow with an elegant leap. I am less afraid of the dead than of getting wet, and settle down for the ride. Perhaps I am a bit lazy as well. Anyway, they do not even see me in the dark. The wind and the rain increase, and I hide from it as best I can, hating the horrible wetness of it all. It is past midnight by the time we arrive, and the doctor is half asleep, dozing by his fire and his whiskey bottle. I can see him clear enough through the window, and get down ready for the opening of the door. Crow taps lightly, and the doctor wakes and rises. He opens the heavy oak door to the two scarecrows that wait on his doorstep, the handcart and its grisly burden in the shadows behind them. Doctor, whispers Crow, come in. Dr. Walters nods. Miscreants such as these are his mainstay, poor human. The whiskey is for his guilt and shame, but the man is driven. They bring the corpses that are his drug, and he always needs more, as many as they can bring. Still, they are never enough. Never will be until he finds his cures. Tom gently lifts the body in its muddy blue dress from the car and enters the room. He lays it, still dripping from the rain, onto a long table cleared for the purpose. Silently, Crow collects their money from the sideboard where it waits for them. Tom giggles, but stops at a glare from Crow. After they have left, Dr. Walter stands and stares at the body. Torn between his conscience and his distaste, he pours himself another drink. "Stop behaving, man. 'Tis late enough already," he mutters to himself, trying to still his shaking hands as he begins unbuttoning the high-necked dress. "I beg your pardon, lassie," he nods solemnly. "It has to be done." "I stay and watch. Do not think I am ghoulish. It is the doctor that I worry about, and think it is better for him not to be completely alone at this time." I rub against his leg, purring, surely to him a sign of life.